Seated. To welcome you all to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. You're our second and final argument for this morning's session. I'll introduce the panel that we have here today for you. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right, Justice Dabney Basil. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that counsel have all checked in with the clerk, so I will ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Rowan Hardesty, and I am representing the appellant, Veena Sharma. This is a case where we have three issues at hand. First is whether a motion for new trial should have been granted. Second, that the informal marriage should not have been found and that the parties should have been found not married. And third, even if they had been found married, the fact that the court found constructive fraud or even actual fraud was not supported by the record. And today we're going to ask this court to reverse and remand all of the issues, or at least on one of the issues. I am assuming that this court has read the facts of this case and doesn't need a recitation. However, there are a couple of preliminary matters that I would like to bring up to the court's attention. First, appellee did file an objection against our statement of facts, saying that we missed some record sites. If this court would like a post-submission brief with those record sites, I'm happy to do so. Throughout this argument, I will point out exactly where some of those record sites are and how appellee had actually misrepresented in their brief when they stated that we misrepresented, how they actually misrepresented. Secondarily, Your Honors, this case was in trial for years. It went through multiple courts and it went through multiple judges. And so although there is an abuse of discretion standard here in all of the matters and all of the issues, and deference should be given to a trial court for credibility issues, we are asking this court to take that into account, the fact that the last judge only heard the last 2 days of trial. So we had one judge in 2000, I believe it was 19, who began the trial, heard the first 2 days, then a second judge in a new court heard the third day, and then the final judge heard the last 2 days. So although a trial judge is typically in the best position to determine credibility of witnesses, they have the ability to view, because they have the ability to view a person's body language, listen to their tone, other behavioral factors. As a result, this court typically will defer to the court's findings regarding credibility of evidence.
Counsel, you might have to speak up just a little bit.
I apologize, Your Honor. In this instance, the credibility should be viewed in the context of the limitations on the ruling judge's perspective. The judge in this case did not have the benefit of hearing the first 3 days of trial, which mainly consisted of the testimony by appellant. The trial judge at best reviewed the same cold record that this court is reviewing today and will review when rendering their opinion. And so we're simply asking that the court balances the deference owed to the trial court's findings under the standard of review within that context. And the context being that the trial judge wasn't privy to much more than this court is. There was some testimony put on by Ms. Sharma during the last 2 days. I believe it was potentially as rebuttal testimony. It could have been as the last bit of her case in chief. But all that evidence that came in with all of the behavioral indicators were not given to the last judge. So moving,
how are we supposed to do this?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How are we supposed to do this?
What I'm asking for is for you to reverse and remand.
I understand, but how are we supposed to apply this standard, this hybrid standard you're talking about?
I'm not necessarily asking for a hybrid standard. I'm just asking that this court look at it within that context, knowing that this court, the trial judge, made decisions that basically this court, in the same vein that this court would be making decisions.
Well, But did the trial court, the final judge who ruled on the motion for new trial, did Judge Livonius need to know anything in terms of having watched people testify to conclude that the Indian divorce decree and the testimony where your client was saying that was fraudulent could and should have been introduced during the trial? I mean, is there a credibility determination to be made about that?
As far as that divorce decree, I think that had that specific witness been allowed to testify, or that it was ruled that he wasn't allowed to testify, then yes, because...
Yeah, and I realize that you were not trial counsel, and that your client went through several lawyers before getting to this point, but, I mean, wasn't it up to her counsel at the time to make a record?
Yes, Your Honor, and our position is that he did put on an offer of proof at trial at a minimum, and then the motion for new trial was a secondary offer of proof by her then attorney. The way that we talk about it in our brief is that when trial counsel was attempting to call that witness, Judge Livoni, I think it was actually the third.
Judge Jones?
Judge Jones, yes, the second judge, never actually said yes or no. And so, but that trial judge did, or that trial counsel did say, this is what this witness would say. And so at a minimum, we feel that that was at least an offer of proof for you to have the ability to rule on that issue. If that isn't sufficient as an offer of proof, then there was the offer of proof that was fully fleshed out at the motion for new trial stage.
The judge wouldn't say yes or no to what?
At the end of that day, it appeared that it was just closed and and the judge didn't rule whether those witnesses could actually testify. There was a question as to whether the witnesses could testify. I believe it was, they were on Zoom and they kind of moved into the testimony from the notary at that point. And then it wasn't revisited by the judge as to whether there was a ruling on that. So clearly this court is aware as to why we are asking for the motion for new trial to be reversed, the denial of that to be reversed, because we feel that fraudulent material fact was important for all of the issues that were tried on this case. Now, as to the second issue, which is whether the parties were informally married, we feel that this also falls under the credibility issue because there was a lot of testimony that was put on by Ms. Sharma that the final judge did not get to hear. And some of that is dealt with those fact statements that we had specifically.
Well, didn't the husband present testimony from a Hindu priest? I mean, it wasn't just her saying we were never married and he was saying yes, we were. I mean, there was, didn't that priest, I think it was in volume 5, of the reporter's record, went through the photographs from the Houston ceremony and explained why that signified a Hindu marriage?
Yes, Your Honor, but my client also put on testimony as to why that wasn't a Hindu marriage and was rather an engagement. And that Hindu priest wasn't actually at the ceremony, and if you look at those photos, they're actually quite grainy. And so there's no indication as to whether that Hindu priest actually knew what occurred at that ceremony.
Well, what about the affidavit? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What about the affidavit that's Plaintiff's Exhibit 9?
Yes, Your Honor. Again, my client had disputed that it was even her that was there. She said that she didn't know who those witnesses were.
But the notary testified.
And the notary did testify.
So why isn't that a credibility question for the trial judge?
Well, Your Honor, the notary made a mistake in his book, and that was reflected in the...
Sure, but he explained the transposition of the two.
He did explain that, and not only that, it was multiple years later, 6 years later, for him to say that, yes, that's the person that came in. It could have been somebody else.
But again, it's credibility. I mean, are you saying that Judge Livonius could not have reviewed the transcripts and I'm not quite sure what she was supposed to do. I mean, she read the testimony of both people about that. She didn't see them testify to it, but could she not have made I go back to Justice Basil's question early on about how we're supposed to be reviewing this under an abuse of discretion standard. If you're saying that when the trial judge that ultimately ruled hadn't seen people testify, then how was she supposed to decide the fact issues?
Yes, Your Honor. I completely understand it. It is a very difficult fine line to take. But ultimately, had she been able to see all of the testimony, then she could have actually made a credibility determination based off of everything. The majority of the testimony that she saw was from appellee and not appellant and not even the notary, not the priest, not, you know, all
of those people. Well, could your client's trial counsel have asked that Judge Lavonius hear more from Ms. Sharma?
And he did. I think there was some testimony put on by Ms. Sharma, but our position is that, you know, she had presented all of her case in chief, and usually that's kind of the first impression that you're able to give. And in this instance, she had that position initially, and then it was flipped on her so that now Mr. Gautam was able to essentially put on his case in chief in front of the final judge and skew the record in that way. So it kind of comes to a head as to how a judge is supposed to deal with that.
Did anybody object to this round robin?
Fortunately, no, Your Honor.
And you're not saying that a trial judge who only has the capacity to review prior testimony through reading the testimony cannot make a credibility determination at all. You're just saying it's much harder to do.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes. I believe that there was a judicial admission issue, and I don't know if this court needs me to go into any of that as I have 3 minutes left, but ultimately, just very quickly, and that kind of goes into the second issue as well, is that by the time that we get to trial, there is the final First Amended petition. And our position is that anything prior to that is just evidentiary, and when Ms. Sharma finally says, I just found out about this, I'm not married to him, she shouldn't be imputed her prior counsel's mistakes for finding that she should have filed a divorce rather than just a SAPSR in this instance. The last issue, very quickly, is regarding the fraud. And again, we don't feel that there was sufficient evidence to reach the fraudulent statement. That there was fraud committed on the estate.
Do you disagree that Ms. Sharma withdrew funds from a retirement account or something when the temporary orders had said she couldn't do, or that no party could do that without judicial permission?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. Unfortunately, at the time, I can't remember exactly the timing of it, but I do know that Ms. Sharma testified that the funds that were used were not only for community, basically for community debts, for community items, and including her own illness when she lost her job. And she had to go through cancer treatments and things like that, and she was limited on funds.
But wouldn't the proper course have been to go to the trial court and say, hey, please give me permission to take this money?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I really can't give any indication as to whether or not that was discussed or not with her counsel. But even if this court does find that there was fraud on the estate, the amounts that were actually calculated were incorrect. Out of all of the money, 70% of those funds that were received with regard to the mortgage were actually used for the mortgage. There was approximately $18,500 that were used to support the appellant during the hardships of losing her job, undergoing those cancer treatment and unemployment. So with regard to whether the money was wasted, it was not, because it was used in a manner that would have been acceptable under family law principles. She didn't go and give it to a third party as a gift or anything to that effect. It was used specifically for community issues. And so we are asking that this court reverse and render or reverse and remand on the final issue.
Well, do you agree or have an opinion about whether Ms. Sharma's trial counsel should have asked for findings of fact and conclusions of law on the fraud on the community finding?
Yes, Your Honor. And I do believe that they should have. But ultimately, what we've been finding is that it would just have been a regurgitation of what was in the decree. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Leanne Diamond. I represent Gautam Johnny, and it has been some time before I had the honor of arguing a case to the Court of Appeals, so I apologize for my nervousness at this point. But I would like to say that we are here today on an appeal where we don't believe that any error has been preserved in the record. We're asking the Court of Appeals to affirm the trial court's rulings. The appellant, as she stated, raises three issues on appeal. First, the trial court erred in not granting a new trial. Second, the trial court erred in finding an informal marriage. And third, the trial court erred in finding appellant committed fraud on the community. With regard to the representation that this witness was somehow excluded from testifying, that's not even remotely the case. The witness was not called to testify during the case, during the trial. At the motion for new trial for the first time, he was called as a witness, which Judge Livonius permitted. There was an offer of proof made, at which point he testified that as of November of 2021, he was involved in the case. This is not a situation of newly discovered evidence. He was available to the appellant. He had already done research to provide testimony to the court. He simply wasn't called. Any type of objection on my part early on in the trial was for the purpose of making sure the court knew that when the time came, I did have an objection to this witness testifying. But there was no offer of testimony, offer of the witness, no denial of that by the trial court. In fact, when the hearing on the motion for new trial was held, Judge Livonius specifically asked the appellant's counsel, wasn't this all available at trial? She was going above and beyond to try to make sure that all the relevant evidence to this case was presented. With regard to the first part of appellant's argument about the fact that this is maybe the fourth trial judge to hear this case, that is a matter that should have been brought up through either a motion for new trial, some sort of pre or even post-judgment motion. The first time that we're hearing that they are complaining on that basis is today during argument, and the comments by the appellant that because this judge didn't have the opportunity to see everyone testify and judge their credibility in real time, I mean, what are judges supposed to do when they have deposition testimony read into the record? Just supposed to ignore it, that's somehow not to be considered, or because they can't see the person live testifying, they shouldn't consider it? That's not the case. That has never been the case. But with regard to that issue, clearly, and we provided to Judge Livonius the entire record from all the previous proceedings in this case. There was one hearing from the very first temporary orders hearing that we were not able to obtain. We got a copy of every single transcript of every single proceeding that was all admitted into evidence received by the judge during the trial. So she did have all of that. The comments regarding, I do believe there's been a misrepresentation of the record because the witness, the lawyer from India, never in his testimony characterized this phantom divorce decree as being fraudulent. We don't even know really what they're referring to because the divorce decree I think they're referring to is one that's in a wholly in an Indian dialect that no one spoke. It was apparently translated through the appellant herself obtained a translation of it, and it showed that it pertained to my client, Mr. Johnny, and his first wife in India. So I'm not sure why there's been so much time and effort spent on that issue. The bottom line is, did the trial court here, did Judge Lavonius have legally sufficient evidence to rule the way that she did? And we believe that the record is clear that she did. With regard to the first issue, there was there's no preservation of error because they didn't call their witness during the trial. There was no ruling on an objection, and the witness was available for trial. With regard to the finding of informal marriage,
in the hearing before Judge Jones, was the lawyer's name mentioned at all?
I honestly don't recall that. There was some discussion in front of Judge Jones about obtaining that divorce decree, if I recall correctly, and I got involved in the case, I believe it was in 2020, and the lawyer who I took over from had been disbarred, and so it was a bit of a challenge to get all of his file. So,
well, and I've got a note here that at day three of the final trial, which I think was your first appearance at one of the trial sessions, that Judge Jones had asked Ms. Sharma's then lawyer if he planned to get the divorce decree translated. And that was in October of 2021.
Correct. And so then their lawyer from India got involved in November of 2021 per his testimony. So I don't recall there being any mention of this man's name in October of 2021. I don't think he was involved at that point. But what I did do is I went through this entire file that I was finally able to get, and I pulled out everything that appeared to even remotely pertain to what they were asking about to make sure that in October or November 2021, they had the documents. Whatever I had, they got. So there was.
Did the lawyer speak both Hindi and English?
As far as I know, he testified in English. He did not. He testified in English. I don't know what other dialects he spoke.
Sure.
Okay. So with regard to the finding of informal marriage, the trial court again is the sole credibility of each witness's testimony, and the court can look to both direct evidence as well as circumstantial evidence in determining whether all of the elements of an informal marriage exist concurrently within the state of Texas. And in this case, as Ms. Hardesty mentioned, the appellant filed for divorce twice. Two separate lawyers, once in 2016, once in 2017. She never dismissed her live pleading at trial, which was the divorce pleading. She then files a first amended, SAPS or air quotes here, first amended suit affecting parent-child relationship, but she never dismissed the petition for divorce. And even though it may not strictly be a judicial admission, it's clearly evidentiary as to what her thought process was, at least in 2016 and 2017, when she was first coming to the court seeking emergency temporary orders to exclude my client from having any access to this child and trying to get him kicked out. And also,
Yeah, it's okay. Well, you know, the appellant's position is that was the attorney, that wasn't her. And that she shouldn't basically be held responsible for something that her attorney did.
I understand.
But and you know, obviously she had to have conversations with those attorneys.
Yes, and that kind of brings me to my next observation is that she kind of speaks out of both sides of her mouth. She claims marriage when it suits her for example, she doesn't want to be held responsible for taking my client's money and cashing out her retirement because she was using the funds for community expenses, but yet on the other side of that fence, she wants to claim she never got married, they never got married, the ceremony was not a wedding, she didn't sign, under oath, many, many times, she did not sign the affidavit of marriage. So, I mean, she can't pick which road she wants to go down.
And they're arguing that your client kind of does the same thing. They're, you know, that he amended his tax return simply to reflect the nature of his marital status, things of that nature. You understand that, right?
Yes, yes. I've read that. And I think that the trial court was, I think that her perception of Ms. Sharma's testimony and the fact that we have her pleadings, we have photos of the wedding, we have greeting cards that were sent from her to her husband, telling him how much she loved him, characterizing him as her husband. We have the affidavit of marriage. We have the testimony of Taylor Lynch, the notary. We have the Hindu priest who reviewed all this, said this comports with what a marriage ceremony would look like. We have the consent for the fertility treatment that's signed by both Mr. Johnny and Ms. Sharma as husband and wife. We even went so far when Ms. Sharma continued to testify under oath that she never signed an affidavit of marriage, she was never married to him, not no, but heck no. You know, there's no way that could have happened. We even hired a handwriting expert, Mr. Kurt Paget, who testified about how he reviewed the known signatures and compared to the signature on the affidavit of marriage, and he testified that he was absolutely certain that that Ms. Sharma had signed the affidavit of marriage.
Let me ask you a question real quick about the dueling testimony on the ceremony. You have the Hindu priest who says one thing, and then you have potentially appellant who's saying something else. And refresh me in this. The appellant's testimony was not that these elements like the red sash and things, that those weren't present. Her testimony was that they didn't mean what the Hindu priest said they meant.
That's my memory of what her testimony was.
Okay.
That, for example, the vermilion in the hair, oh no, that doesn't mean anything. The Mangalsutra, that doesn't mean anything. All of these elements or all of these gifts that a bride would wear during a Hindu ceremony, none of those, she denied every single one of them. So I believe that the evidence, the credible evidence before the trial court was that all of the elements, the agreement to be married, living together in the state of Texas, and representing to others was satisfied through both direct as well as circumstantial evidence, and based on an abuse of discretion standard, she clearly had evidence that she could have found was credible and did find was credible in finding that an informal marriage between the parties existed. The third issue that is raised by the appellant is with regard to fraud on the community. I think the record is pretty clear the extent to which I walked through the evidence before the trial court, the bank statements, the fact that she knew that she was supposed to be taking the money that my client was paying to her to pay the mortgage on this house and that she didn't do it. She kept the money for herself. And whatever she used the money for, like you recognize, if she needed to use that money for some other purpose, she could have come to the court and filed a motion for, you know, new temporary orders. Lord knows, it had been a long time since the previous temporary orders had been entered, and asked for permission to use those funds in some other way, ask for my client to have to pay some different amount. There were all kinds of options open.
What about her argument? I may have trouble expressing this, but in essence, the trial court held her liable for money that was actually paid to the mortgage company.
I think that the record, I know that's her allegation. The record shows, I went through each payment that either she had made or hadn't made. I think there was almost a year that she didn't make any payments whatsoever. And the evidence was that she had at the time that she allowed this mortgage to go into default and then redid the mortgage, she had $11,000 of my client's money sitting in her account. So yes, that's her testimony that the money went elsewhere. But I believe if there was some question as to whether the damages were calculated correctly or not, that should have been dealt with through motion for reconsideration or a motion for new trial or anything saying, judge, you know, your judgment is this, but the math doesn't add up. If that's the argument, the math doesn't work.
So you're not saying that there necessarily wasn't error, just that it wasn't preserved on that issue?
Absolutely. I don't claim to be a mathematician, but we did the best that we could to show the damages. And I think under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1A, I believe it is, that you have to obtain a ruling on an objection. You have to at least present to the trial court that something was done incorrectly and give the trial court an opportunity to fix it. And that was not done in this case whatsoever. The sole issue in the motion for new trial was our Indian lawyer should have been permitted, you should grant the new trial because our Indian lawyer should have been permitted to testify.
Yeah, let me go back to that for a second because there's a disconnect to me, and maybe Ms. Sharma's counsel is the one to answer this, but so the argument that there should have been testimony about that alleged divorce decree from India that nobody can read, that testimony should have been allowed, but at the same time there was a document admitted into evidence that purported to be a translation of that document or some other document that actually has these parties' names on it. So
we don't know because the actual document, the one in the Indian dialect, is referred to in the transcript as Exhibit B. As my client is being questioned, is this the one you're claiming as your divorce decree? But it was never admitted into evidence. The translation.
But it was attached to the motion for a new trial, or was attached to some motion?
I believe so, but it's kind of a red herring because the appellant herself obtained a translation of that document. There was never.
And when was the translation admitted?
It was admitted as part of the motion for new trial hearing.
Not prior to that.
I don't think it was.
Yeah, I think it was at the motion for new trial.
Yes. So we're asking the court to affirm the judgment. We believe that the judge, being the sole judge of the credibility of these witnesses, ruled appropriately, and we're asking the court to affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Ms. Hardesty, do you have any, you know, this idea that you can have a court order that says this is what you're supposed to do, but you don't do it, but instead you use that money on maybe a benevolent purpose? Do you have any authority that can negate a finding of a fraud on the court?
Your Honor, the way that the fraud statute appears to run is that it would be used for something that would be more nefarious, like I'm either using it for a third party or that I am diverting it into another account offshore.
But are there cases out there that have like an exception for legit purposes, even though you didn't get court permission?
I don't see that typically. As a family law attorney, that's usually an issue that's presented at trial, and the judges make a decision based off of that. But I don't I personally have not looked for authority on that specific issue. I'm happy to brief it for you if you would like me to. So real quickly, Your Honor, as far as your question on that document, it was given to my client on the third day of trial.
You're talking about Exhibit I?
Exhibit I.
Wait, that's the translation. I is the translation.
No, I'm talking about Exhibit B. Yes.
Okay.
And the yes, Your Honor. And that was what was admitted at the motion for new trial.
But it's my understanding that wasn't actually Exhibit B was never offered and admitted at the motion for new trial. But the translation, I don't understand where that translation came from, because it doesn't seem to have helped your client's case for her lawyer to have introduced a translation, Exhibit I, that appears to say that he and his first wife were divorced.
Right, and I truthfully don't know where that translation came from, because the testimony from the Indian lawyer who spoke the specific dialect that was from, right, and English, said this doesn't have his name in it at all.
Okay, but does it matter if we've got evidence that your client presented that translated something and says, yes, this is Mr. Sorry, I'm drawing a blank. Anyway.
Husband.
Yeah. The husband, right. Husband. And so our position is that, you know, the motion for new trial should have been granted, because even, you know, that, I'm not sure if Exhibit I was actually,
It was admitted.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that was a mistake by an attorney or not, but it was that, you know, the testimony from the Indian lawyer says this is fraudulent. The exhibit.
Well, he didn't use that word fraudulent.
So what he said, from what I remember, is, let me see if I have that.
Didn't he say that it had other people's names in it, and that it didn't look like any sort of divorce decree that he had ever seen before, because it wasn't long enough to have addressed like children issues or anything like that. That's my recollection.
That is essentially what he said. So although he didn't use the word fraudulent, it can be inferred that it was a fraudulent document. The last little piece that I just quickly wanted to talk about, which I discusses the reputation in the community, which is kind of the linchpin here in this case. Yes, they cohabitated. We don't know if it was as husband and wife, but they did agree that they cohabitated. But specifically, you know, Ms. Sharma did say, you know, that she didn't file her taxes. She filed her taxes single. She purchased homes only in her name as an unmarried woman. All of the accounts were separate bank accounts. There was no evidence presented from anybody in the community that said, yes, these two people presented themselves as husband and wife.
How about the notary in 2013?
That's the only one, and
the document for the from the fertility clinic.
Right, and the document itself, so there was testimony where appellate said to the fertility clinic that she told them that she was not married.
That's what she testified to, but the judge didn't have to believe that.
No, she did not have to believe that. But the testimony specifically did say that they asked, and that was testimony from day one or two, I believe, as well. So ultimately, we believe that, you know, this court should have ruled opposite. At a minimum, you know, the calculation should have been done. I went through the exact documents that were presented and went through and dissected.
Can you point us to where that error, if any, was preserved in the trial court?
I believe that could have been, it can be brought up on the first, as the first issue here, Your Honor, without it.
You're simply saying that the amount proven isn't sufficient to support the amount in the judgment.
Correct, Your Honor.
So would this be like a judgment nunc pro tunc situation,
why I said reversed and rendered rather than, or reversed and remanded.
I know your time's up, but I've got one more question for you before you sit down.
Sure.
What about the appellee's argument that even if it's not a judicial admission, those first two divorce petitions, that the Sapser didn't, and nothing else, ever actually revoked or dismissed the divorce petitions?
So my position is, and our position is, that the Sapser actually specifically revoked it in that language. It said that she, I believe it said, I specifically, let me find it. It specifically said, I have found out that he is married and therefore I cannot be married to him within that SAPSR document. So I think that that language itself is sufficient to make the other admissions only evidentiary rather than judicial, and that it would supersede. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you very much. We appreciate the argument. Your case is submitted, and with that, you can feel free to go about your day. Thanks so much. We're in recess.